What's up, you goddamn degenerates? Today's May 23rd, 2019. This is the QTR Podcast. Before we get started, want to shout out some of my patrons that hook me up on Patreon and make the podcast possible. First are my friends over at Quantamize.com, Quantamize. Quantamize has the number one alternative to a Bloomberg terminal, an AI-powered platform that gives you access to over 10,000 stocks, options, and cryptos, as well as different types of investment strategies using those instruments, and you can get them entirely for free. Right now, the entire platform is being offered for free. You can get a link to that in my podcast description. Also, the podcast is brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound.ai provides an AI-powered service that helps you sift through the bullshit when it comes to the M&A rumors that hit the wires pretty much every day now. There's at least one of them. It's going to look at the source, and it's going to use all types of algorithms to try and give you a determination as to which M&A rumors you may want to pay attention to and which ones you may want to avoid. Could save you some capital, you weekly call and put buying degenerate fools. I know you are. Don't even try. Don't even try to lie to me. Oh, I invest for the long haul. I see you in there. I see you in the weekly options. Don't worry about it. I won't tell anybody. We'll keep the secret here. Also, my friends over at HellaBacon.com. Hella Bacon's a bunch of guys from Texas. They shoot machine guns out of helicopters. Check them out at HellaBacon on Twitter, and there's a link to them also in my podcast description. What would the podcast be without shouting out some of my top patrons as well, like my friends over at Corvus Gold, my friend Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, Russ Valenti, Piggly Wiggly, Cool Death is in the house, Nathan Weiss is in the house, Matt Merle is still in the house, what's going on, brother, and William Davis, as well as my newest patrons that have joined me over the last couple of days, like the folks over at Covefi Capital, Yoda Dog, Steven Rasputic, Don Patrick hit me up on PayPal, thank you, my brother, Andy M., Matt Kiefer, Valentine Baker Pasha, Rob Lichmich still here, Tom Luongo, and Andre Gavrilov just re-upped, I think, Christian Kohlheim and Mark Balker. Before we get started, just two other things I want to remind you. First and foremost, I'm not an investment advisor. Do your research elsewhere, okay? That means not only do I not want you bitching and moaning when things that I mentioned maybe I'm doing go the wrong way because you were stupid enough to follow my advice, not only do I not want to hear that bitching and moaning, I don't want praise when things that I say do well, okay? So we just cancel out the praise and cancel out the bitching and moaning. And then just do your research elsewhere and celebrate privately. I don't really care. You know, I love you guys. I really do. But you win some, you lose some. I know how the game works. You know how the game works. Let's just fucking keep things moving forward, right? For fuck's sake. All right. Finally, there's a two-drink minimum to this podcast. Today's Thursday. We're going on a holiday weekend here. So I'm going to ask you to actually insert and turn your key with me to engage what I call emergency three-drink minimum for this podcast, not only because I got Mark Spiegel on, who's also a degenerate, but also because we're heading into the holiday weekend, so let's kick it up a notch. Like in War Games, when the guy's got to turn that second key and he can't do it, I need you to turn that key with me, and let's just ratchet this one up to a three-drink minimum today. Because, folks, Tesla's trading at $197 a share, all right? We got lots to fucking talk about here, so why don't we get it popping? Oh, we got motherfucking Mark Spiegel in the house! If you don't know Mark Spiegel, he is the portfolio manager at Stanfill Capital and probably one of the most outspoken critics of Tesla on the street. He's got a filthy mouth, and that's why I love him. Hello, Mark Spiegel. How are you today?
Well, whatever I did to help get you banned from Seeking Alpha, I'm happy to have done my part.
Actually, what they said was, did we discuss this when they announced it or no, me and you?
No, you just put a tweet out. It was after the last podcast you and I did. By the way, let me just say, as long as we're on that topic, that I'm actually honored to be here. I consider you to be like the Johnny Carson of asshole stock market podcasts.
Thank you.
I'm very happy to be here.
Whatever that means, thank you for the compliment. I accept it. Whatever, you know, as I often say to the people that are listening, whatever you guys are for, I support it, you know? So anyways, what happened was they had initially told me it was cool to do the podcast and syndicate it through there and write these little blurbs up for them. And I guess Ellie, who is the CEO there, was fine with it. And then word came down from the top, the guy above Ellie, who I think his name is David Jackson. who I think is the founder of the site. And he said,
he is the founder. I met him many years ago in New York at like a cocktail party they did. Yeah.
Yeah, he said
nice guy, by the way.
But, very nice people at Seeking Alpha. I like them very much. George Moriarty has been a friend of mine for years. He's just been so cool to work with and so nice. And even when he called me to tell me that the podcast wasn't going to be up there anymore, and not only that, but they were taking down the ones that were already up there.
Oh my God!
He was very.
It's like they've wiped all memories of you. It's like that Schwarzenegger movie, Eraser or whatever. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So he was real cool about it. He called me and he was really nice about it. So, anyways, moving on from that, my kind friend, how are you?
I'm good. Well, I mean, I'm certainly good. You know, having a good year this year. I'm happy about that. I'm actually very happy for my LPs who have stuck with me through, you know, a really awful 2017 and 2018. Of course, yeah, there's a lot of time left in this year, so who the hell knows?
Yeah, you can fuck it up, right? It's only May.
Absolutely.
You know?
Any day. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Any day. Just, you know, you have a couple too many drinks in the morning. By the end.
Don't confuse me with you, okay? I am not a day drinker.
And the whole thing could be done by 2 p.m. Eastern time one day. Anyway.
Yeah, it's unlikely to happen that way, but
What are your LPs saying to you? Like, what did they say to you, like, last couple of years, and what are they saying now?
Well, you know, that's a great question. So the all-time low for the fund in terms of, like, NAV, call it the all-time drawdown we set our high water mark at the end of 2016. So the all-time drawdown was 420 day last year. And I sent out an email to all of my LPs and I said, look, you know, I'm 100% sure this buyout is bullshit. I'm paraphrasing myself. And when I saw that, we actually got shorter because Musk has defined our risk, right? The stock was, I don't know, call it 380 or 370. And
right.
But we've got tons of liquidity, and any of you guys want out, you can be out the end of this month. I'm totally cool with that. I totally understand. You know, we've had a terrible 18 months at that point. And I think I had at the time, I don't know, 15 or 16 LPs. I got back maybe 5 responses. Every response was basically, Mark, the only way we're pulling out of your fund is if you close the Tesla short position. You know, these people have been, for the most part, I mean, we've lost a few, but they've basically been as patient as I am. They believe in this as much as I do, you know, probably partially because I convinced them to, rightly or wrongly. So they've been great. And you know, this year has been fantastic. I mean, as of tonight, on a gross basis, which for a lot of people is net, anyone who isn't yet back to the high water mark, you know, we're up about 30% this year. So we've made back almost everything from our drawdown, not quite everything. So, but you know, we'll see. Look, I mean, it's only May, and I know better than anyone that anything can happen in the stock market. So,
yeah, absolutely. Do me a favor, Mark. Just back up from the mic just slightly, all right? Just a tiny bit more. That's it. I know did fucking 20 minutes of sound check. I'm trying
How's this? Is this better?
Yeah, that is better.
I moved it away more. Okay, yep, good.
Thank cool. you.
Yeah.
I went back and listened to a bunch of the podcasts that we did and the one that I just did with Dave Collum, and the audio is just, you know, and I think a lot of it isn't on my end because I keep trying to fuck with it here, but a lot of times people are either too close to the mic or it's a bad connection. So I'm just now in the future going to be making sure that things are clear, because if I can't fucking turn it on and listen to it, not only because I find myself annoying to listen to, but also if the quality is not good, I can't imagine how people are making it through these podcasts when the quality isn't good. So sorry to bring that up again right there.
Well, I've listened and I didn't have any problem, but of course I'm in love with the sound of my own voice. So it's a little bit of a different situation there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so look, Tesla, I'm happy to talk about Tesla. I'm actually very relaxed about Tesla. I don't know if I said it last time maybe, but I mean, I've said for a while that I think this stock is just done. I think it was done when people saw, you know, how bad Q1 was, like that was the end,
right?
Like right there, you know, and all this other stuff is just noise and bullshit on the way down. And they're just too much, you know. My friend Anton Wallman wrote a great piece today on thestreet.com, which is just very concisely reiterates the primary reason I've been short this thing for 4 years, which is competition. There's just too many other cars coming out, and he talked about that. You know, I will say something interesting, by the way. I had a dinner last night with some friends of mine who were all hedge fund guys themselves, and I asked them an interesting question, you know, because the big mistake here I made on this Tesla short, obviously, was the timing, because I've been short this thing in real size for probably 5 years now, probably, right. You know, real size since probably sometime in 2014.
Yeah, you shorted it on the way up, didn't you?
Well, my big short position actually initially went on at around 250, which wasn't terrible. I didn't short it at 30. You know, I put on a very tiny position in the 90s, but like an irrelevantly small position. Just let's keep an eye on this and learn more about it position.
Right.
And most of my position was mid-200s, but I just got killed on whipsaws, you know, realized losses. Oh, it's 300, I got to cover some. Oh, it's back to 250, I can put it back on. Oh, it's 300, you know, just continual, you know, buying high and selling low. It's just cycling over and over again. That's, you know, if I just did nothing from 250, then, you know, we would have been flat. But I couldn't do that because it was a big position, and I didn't want this thing to grow to whatever, 60% of my fund or whatever. But anyway, so the point I'm making is this, which is everything that we're seeing happen today, I saw 4 years ago. And I'm no great seer. I just saw, you know, the development cycle on a car is 4 or 5 years, and I saw all the announcements from all these other guys about what they would have coming out, and then I figured, you know, the electric car market is only going to be so big anyway, and it was just totally obvious to me. So in my head, I'm thinking, oh, the market is going to see this. It's totally obvious, and, you know, it'll discount back reality from 4 years, and, you know, this stock will take a dive and that'll be it. Well, of course, it never happened. And the discussion that I had with these guys last night was an interesting one. And I think they're right. And this is the lesson I'll take out of this, which is if you've got a growth stock, and as long as the top line growth is doing what people think it will do, they could not care less about what's going to happen in 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, or 1 year, even though theoretically they should. Like theoretically, what's happening right now, for instance, the Tesla sales in Europe, where the X and S are getting destroyed by the Jaguar and the Audi, and, you know, as you know, the Mercedes and the Porsche come very soon. I mean, that should have – it wasn't. So if I were to do this whole thing over again, I would have – I mean, basically, I knew too much. I did too much research about this market, and it was a lot more than the stock market actually – no, seriously, it was more than the stock market cared. If I were going to do this again, I would say, okay, sometime between – you know, Q4 of 18 and Q1 of 19 is peak Tesla, and that's the end. And I should have shorted this stock, you know, 3 months to 6 months ahead of that, maybe 6 months ahead to allow the market to start discounting that. In fact, the discounting really only happened like 2 weeks ahead, because this stock essentially peaked, not all time peak, but peaked for this move around mid-December. And, you know, that was the end of Q4, and then Q1 was awful, and it just – the market saw that and it just took it all the way down. So that's what I'll take out of this. And, you know, this is advice for me to you guys out there. You know, don't short, no matter how overvalued it is, you know, don't short a rapidly growing stock until you sense that that growth, you know, is about to end, and then do it just a little bit ahead of that. And, you know, in this case, it was pretty easy to figure that out just based on the development cycles on all these other cars. So, you know, it was an interesting lesson. I mean, of course, the wild card in this thing was this crazy securities fraud committing CEO, and a reasonable person. And by the way, I mean, I wrote articles about his lying back in 2014 on Seeking right. Alpha. And a reasonable person might have said, well, it's okay to short this one 4 years before peak sales because the CEO was committing securities fraud and he's going to get nailed long before then. Well, of course, we know how that worked out. I mean, basically, you know, I don't know if he's got – you know, naked pictures of half the SEC or what, but for whatever reason, they've let this guy basically slide, you know?
Well, so, one reason would be, you know, if the Department of Justice was working on something in parallel, as often happens, and maybe they're giving them kind of leeway and saying, all right, you know, you walk in with the slap on the wrist, we're working on the big boy case against this company. But, you know, I said the same thing about Herbalife, and of course that famously didn't happen. Let me just say something real quick about what you said about growth companies and the revenue. As long as the top line's going, everything else is fine with growth companies. I mean, that's really, when you say that to me, it feels like a microcosm of how the whole economy and the really the entire global economy. That's the attitude that they've adopted, right? That the bottom line doesn't matter. The balance sheet doesn't matter, right? The balance sheet of the United States doesn't matter, right? The fact that we're, you know, we're running a deficit every year doesn't matter as long as the, you know, the tax revenue continues to come up or whatever. You know, we're just, there's just no focus on profitability and there's no focus on savings. And I think you're right. I mean, we saw it with Wayfair, right? Which is like a horrible company, but they're growing their top line. And
I'm short Wayfair now. We can talk about some of that stuff too, actually.
Sure,
so, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
But the point is, you know, that revenue line was going. And now that's all, you know, in a 0% interest rate environment and a market that runs on hopes and, you know, unicorns and rainbows. That doesn't matter. Well, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's interesting that that when it comes to growth stocks, all the market cares about is growth, and that's all they care about. Right? Growth meaning top line growth. Yeah, that's exactly what you're saying. I mean, yeah, that's the way these central banks have been running the economies and everything. But the discussion I had last night with these guys, which was a good one, that it doesn't work that way for value stocks. So, for instance,
right,
you know, you had like, I don't know if you remember, but like the Yellow Pages companies, let's say, right? And everybody knew that 5 years from point X, you know, these guys would be in a lot of trouble because the internet was growing. But that day, 5 years ahead of that, you know, you could have bought these guys for whatever, 3-4 times earnings or EBITDA, whatever the multiples were. Nobody cared. Nobody would buy them because they were for value investors. And value investors were like, that's bullshit because this company is going to be worthless in 5 years, right?
Right.
Apparently, growth investors, they don't look beyond the, you know, that top line. Listen, maybe this is stuff that in some ways should be very obvious, but it also seems obvious to me that, you know, if you've got a company priced for incredible growth for the next 15 years and you know that growth's going to stop in 4 years, well, that should be built into the price. But here in the real world, it isn't, at least not in a bull market, right? So anyway, it was an interesting lesson, an interesting experience. And look, you know, this thing could spike a little bit now. I mean, you know, as you know, and people follow me on Twitter, I'm not a short-term trader at all, but I'll add to positions. I've added to Tesla on the way down. And I said the whole time that if they raised, this stock would spike like 20 bucks and then resume the sell-off trend. And, you know, it spiked, I don't know, $23 or whatever, 24, whatever it was. So I did put more on there. And opportunistically, I've put more on. And this isn't something that I said on Twitter, but it's in my head the whole time. Everybody can look on a chart and see that support in the low 180s, which the stock touched pre-market today, because, you know, that was the last major low in like the fall of 2016, and it's key technical support, blah, blah, blah. And in my head, I've been saying, you know what, this thing will get down there. And I thought, okay, I thought it would get to 180, and I guess it got to 182 or whatever. And then it'll pop back up to 200, and 200 will be the new resistance. So yeah, I put a little bit more on the pop this morning. Not much, just a little bit.
Think about the fact that the stock traded with 181 handle today. And honestly, I mean, I'm not trying to J you off, but like your LPs looking back at the statement that you made when the stock was at $380 a share, after this guy comes out, I mean, when was the last time you saw a short seller just stand in the face of a CEO saying, oh, we've got buyout interest on the table, and just say, fuck you, no you don't? And
well, every big short seller did that. I'll tell you a quick story. Maybe I didn't tell you this story. But, you know, even though I'm a very small fund, because I've been so vocal on this, you do a Google search for Tesla shorts, I probably come up pretty fast. I got a bunch of calls from class action securities lawyers the next day looking for a lead plaintiff on the short side to use against Musk. I don't know, maybe I didn't tell you the story. And I said to them, listen, I said, you know, not only did I not cover there, but I put a little bit more on because right, as far as I was concerned, this guy just defined my risk. I said, but why don't you call some of the big boys out there who were short this? And I don't have to name them here. We know who they are. And to a man, they all said to me, yeah, we talked to all those guys and they all did the same thing you did. Nobody covered. It was an interesting situation, you know?
Well, it's certainly, when you talk about the fact that Musk is unique in the sense that he's crazy and just doesn't abide by securities laws, and it really is the wild card here that, I mean, this business would be in trouble without him, but with him, it's, I mean, he's almost the short's best friend, which I don't think that he realizes, but, you know, to just, what does that tell you? I mean, what does it tell you about short sellers, number one, that you have to be, as Mark Cohodes would say, you'd have to have a genetic defect to be a short seller. But, you know, there's no way that if Mary Barra from GM comes out and tweets that General Motors is seeing buyout interest, that people are just going to come out and say, ah, fuck you, you know, you're wrong. We think you're lying. And you guys said, well, you've lied about so much shit so far that, you know, why not this? And the idea of defining risk is great because as a short seller, that's the one thing you always worry about is that infinite upside risk. So there you're capped at 10%, right? Assuming it goes through that the way that he says it does.
Right. Well, there were two issues there. One issue is his credibility, and we don't believe him at all anymore. And for that matter, you know, nor does the market. I mean, look at the Model Y, look at the autonomy day, all these pumps that were supposed to put the stock way to fuck up there. None of them did shit. I think the only reason this leaked memo overnight did anything is the stock was incredibly short-term oversold, and it was just primed, right, you know, to seize on something, right? You know the old expression, the stock makes the news doesn't make the stock, right? You know, other than extraordinary events like a war or whatever. And, you know, here's one of these cases where, you know, people seize on that as the excuse to, oh, maybe I better cover some kind of thing. I mean, there's no question that people have gotten a lot shorter on this thing, and that's what happens, you know? So look, you know, I'm looking here on my screen. So the high today, the intraday high was 199.46 or 47. And if I'm right, you know, that'll be the high, or at least that'll be the, you know, the closing high. I don't know, maybe it can penetrate 200. If I'm right about, you know, hitting 180, bouncing to 200, 200 is a new resistance, and then the downtrend resumes. But if I'm wrong, you know, I'm wrong. You know, I mean, it's not going to affect how I feel about this thing, you know, over time.
Yeah, the email today, my first impression of the email today was it's fake because it didn't list his email address in the email client. It just said Elon Musk in the photo that was posted today. So I was like, somebody renamed themselves Elon Musk on Gmail and sent themselves an email. And then, you know, as the day started to progress, I started to think, you know, actually, once they confirmed it, I was thinking, like, first thing I did was went back and looked at the language that they use. You know, net orders. You know, that's a very specifically worded email. Second thing I looked at is whether or not it could violate his second SEC settlement, which it looks like it might.
You know, if I were Musk's lawyer, and, you know, he's already got, like, 7,000 lawyers. I don't think he needs another one, but I would just argue that all that memo did was, you know, reiterate very publicly declared guidance. It wasn't any kind of material change. And I think that argument would hold water. I'm not one of these people who says that this was any kind of violation of anything.
Yeah, they're not going to make this guidance, right, for the quarter. I mean, and nobody thinks that they're going to make it.
The best I can come up with, and I actually put this on Twitter early today, you know, generously for the company – you know, I can come up with maybe around 75,000 unit deliveries versus for the quarter versus guidance of 90 to 100. And the ASPs, average selling prices, will be terrible because they've done so much cost cutting. I mean, they just They just cut prices again, you know, yesterday, the day before on the S&X and threw in free supercharging on inventory cars. That I think, you know, any incremental sale over the 63,000 from last quarter, you know, will be like profitless, you know, or, you know, on a net basis, because part of that, the first 63,000 will be at lower ASPs. I mean, it's a long-winded way of saying that I expect assuming they sell, let's say 75,000, maybe 80,000, I think the Q2 loss X one-time items will be roughly the same on a GAAP basis as the Q1 loss. Like, there will be no improvement. You know, there could be some improvement because of, they took some inventory write-downs and claimed some restructuring charges in Q1. But then again,
that would be a devastating number.
Yeah, and the way prices are collapsing on the used cars and inventory cars now, they may have to take another inventory write-down. I don't know. I don't know if they took enough in Q1 to allow for what's going on now. I don't know. I mean, look, they can pull some bullshit and recognize some deferred full self-driving revenue or something like that. But then again, that thing is such a fucking – I can say that now because we're not on Seeking Alpha. That thing is such a fucking disaster. I mean, listen, those guys at Consumer Reports, they are huge fans of electric cars in general.
Right.
I mean, they're real global warming fetishists, okay? And they've bent over backwards to give every possible break to – I call them carbon tards now. They've bent – because I used to say green tards – but that's not really fair because I'm all for clean water and and reducing diesel emissions and all that. I'm just not obsessed with carbon emissions in an incredibly complex climate system where, in fact, a little bit of warming would actually mean there would be a lot more crop growth worldwide and fewer people would be hungry. But some libtards' waterfront home, they're afraid it'll be underwater, so that's no good in Malibu or whatever. Anyway, I got sidetracked. So – So anyway, the Consumer Reports guys just bend over backwards. So, you know, if Jake, I forget his last name, but he's like sort of the chief engineer at CR Automotive. And, you know, he and I have knocked heads over many times in the past. You know, if he says, hey, this thing should not be on the road, this is dangerous, then it's really bad because, you know, Jake is the kind of guy who has given them any possible break. And, you know, I respect Jake's integrity for being the global warming guy that he is and still saying, hey, this is fucking dangerous. You know, this thing should not be out there. And, of course, the biggest issue here is not the dopey Teslemming cult member who buys this car and drives it, you know, with no hands and you know, and has sex with himself. And let's face it, very few real Tesla owners would actually be able to get a woman to have sex with them in one of these cars, right? So, you know, that porn thing, those people didn't own that car. They were paid, I'm sure, to have sex in the car. Most of your Tesla owners, all their sex is, you know, like the car. It's like autonomous sex, if that's a word. So anyway, you know, if that person does that to himself, that's fine. That's his problem. But of course, you know, he's got this 5,000 or 4,000 pound vehicle on the road with people who are not volunteering for this. And there was some scary YouTube footage the other day, you know, of this thing just crossing the line. And if someone was coming the other way, I mean, it's really, you see, I do not know what the NHTSA
is
fucking doing here. I mean, what the fuck do they need? You know, what is their job? You know, I mean, as taxpayers, why are we wasting budget money on them? Because Tesla clearly, almost any responsible automaker these days, when they see a problem, they're very concerned about liability, if nothing else, and they step up and do a voluntary recall. And Tesla, of course, just buries all this shit. And today, you know, Inside EVs had tweeted an article, the headline about an article about the Consumer Reports thing. And Musk, like, you know, replied to that tweet, and he's like, so it goes. It's like, stupid. Yeah.
The thing that they published that was like, Consumer Reports is not happy with the way that it's being reported.
Yeah,
that one?
Yeah.
Just take them by their own words, right?
And Musk's answer is, so it goes. I mean, and I put this on Twitter. Those are the words of a sociopath who just does not give a flying fuck about the lives of innocent people out there, or even people who are guilty enough and dumb enough to buy his cars and use this system. So I don't know what it'll take. I mean, a school bus getting – I don't know. I mean, a famous person, you know, getting off in this, or, you know, look, I mean – part of me expects that, like, any hour we'll see a press release from the NHTSA where they've informed Tesla that they either have to disconnect the system or at the very least set it up, and allegedly they should be able to do this, for continual hand-on-wheel being required,
right, right.
Not that you could take it off even for 30 seconds. But then, you know, you'll have these dummies who – you see them on YouTube who buy these – you know, whatever, they tape a soda can or whatever to the wheel so it thinks that your hand is on it. But that's a minority of people. I mean, most of these people at least will keep their hands on the wheel, but that, of course, would not necessarily stop them from stretching the seat back and relaxing and whatever. And if you're relaxed, you're still going to lose half a step if something goes wrong.
Right.
And sure as shit, something goes wrong. I mean, usually it's just to you. Like, there was this a Model X they showed yesterday that literally drove up a construction rail, right? You know, and people thought, oh, isn't that funny? It's on rails, whatever. It only got lucky because that thing was ramped, so it was able to drive up it as opposed to hitting it head on like that poor guy did who got killed last year in California in his Model X, right? So, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy. I hope they do something.
Well,
you know?
I was stunned when the former head of the NHTSA was the guy that came out.
Yeah, well, he works for Consumer Reports now, that guy.
Right.
Yes.
And what I have to say is, if you're current head of the NHTSA, how do you ignore the fact, like, say you've been doing nothing or you've been putting off doing a recall because you don't want to ruffle any feathers, and that's fine, right? But now, if you're the head of the NHTSA currently, what you have to think about is every fuck up from this point forward, every person that dies, one of these things that drives through a fucking Burger King and kills somebody, every one of them that decapitates a driver by sliding under an 18-wheeler like's been happening, not only is it on you, but now you're on notice, though, publicly, right? So, that shit happens, people are going to turn around and go, hey, you know, Commissioner Fuckstick said, you can't do this. You know, he said this should be a recall. He said that these are human guinea pigs, I think were the words that he used. And that's got to be echoing in the back of your head, right? You're going to be thinking about, shit, I'm going to have to really face the music. It's like, you know, it's like you're the head of the NHL. And the previous commissioner from 2015 says, we really got to stop fighting in hockey because somebody's going to get seriously injured. And then all of a sudden during a game, a fight breaks out and a guy knocks another guy, you know, into a coma and he dies. You know, like you got to face the music of what that guy said, because now it's in the public discourse, right? Like Consumer Reports, like, lobbed it out into the public discourse. I mean, everybody reads Consumer Reports, not just people that are following the Tesla story. So the regular mom and pop at home, should somebody else die, say, well, you know, so-and-so said, he said this was going to happen, and now it happened. So then it becomes a question of, is it incompetence at the NHTSA now? Because it just, to me, seems like over the last 3-4 years, Mark, we haven't seen any type of profound... I mean, the things like you're talking about, like this thing jumping across the line on a two-lane highway and into incoming traffic. I mean, what is that? Like,
yeah, well, clearly this system should not be able to be used there. And the car knows where it is, and it should just be disabled on two-lane roads.
Part of the problem is... when they and this would not be as big of an issue if Musk had not pitched this system the way that he did from the get-go. If this was pitched as driver assist.
Yeah, but of course then people wouldn't be paying an extra $5,000 or $6,000 for it or whatever it costs. I mean, they just cut the price on that, or they cut the aftermarket price on it or whatever. So that's all his margin on these cars is getting people to buy that system. So, I mean, he's shameless. He is just fucking shameless. Look, we've gone over this a bunch of times, but for that asshole to get on 60 Minutes, national TV, show, hey, hands free, you know, and she goes, the car is driving itself? And he goes, yep, this car is like driving itself. I mean, he is a fucking wise guy, you know? And you know what? He's going to get his ass sued on this, and maybe one day he goes to jail just for that, putting aside all the bullshit other fraud he might be committing, you know? So
and then,
we'll see.
And then Ross Gerber says yesterday, did you see his interview with Gabe Hoffman? Wait, just hold on, because I know there's a personal insult coming. Just hold off on that.
No, there isn't. It was just like, I don't even pay attention.
You
he's
fucking
just
liar.
So dumb.
There definitely was. Well, that's a personal insult. What do you think that is?
Oh, it is? Is that insulting to say somebody's really dumb and I don't pay attention to them? Yeah, that's just the way I talk about people. It occurred to me that might be seen as insulting. I'm sorry.
An insult's coming. So you're like, no, it's not. He's just an asshole.
I'm sorry, Ross. I didn't mean to insult you for saying you're the dumbest fuck I've ever seen in the financial services industry.
Hang on. You've gone way off the rails here.
Oh, okay.
My point is, did you see the interview he did with Gabe Hoffman?
No, and Gabe is good. Gabe has this story of his hands.
Him and Gabe did a debate on Cheddar yesterday, which unfortunately the stupid producers at Cheddar cut way too short, and it was really turning into a good one. It was getting good because Gabe was very calm and calculated and laying on facts, and
yeah.
Gerber was really losing his mind. You could just tell.
I saw you tweet about that, actually. Yeah,
he must be running out of interns to answer the phones, you know, from his quote-unquote clients. But regardless, yeah. What he said was, I think on Twitter this morning, Gerber, and he's a big advocate for it, he said, oh, it's just having a little problem handling LA traffic.
Look,
it's like he's pitching the fucking thing as full self-driving. The guy said there's going to be robo-taxis on the road next year, and you're talking about LA traffic. You're talking about LA traffic.
Look, there are two kinds of bulls on Tesla. There are the ones with no facts, and that's Ross Gerber's category. They're like, oh, you know, have you driven one? Or, oh, Elon Musk is God. Or, oh, we're saving the world. You know, just total stupid shit. Or there's the ones with completely made-up facts, and that's where, you know, Kathy Wood from ARC is. Oh, yeah, they're leading in autonomy. They're leading in this, which is, you know, anyone who knows anything knows that's total bullshit, right? Those are the two kinds of bulls, no facts or made-up facts. So that's why I don't waste a lot of time on these people anymore. Like, in my head, I've just moved on, you know? I mean, so, yeah. I mean, look, I've put on a bunch of other shorts, all much smaller than Tesla. I mean, Tesla's by, like, 7x my biggest short. And then I put on a bunch of other garbage companies. Not necessarily – yeah, they're all garbage companies, let's face it. You know, and
I think what happens next is, and I tweeted this out yesterday, I think we get some kind of fake rumor about a buyout or a partnership that winds up falling through. I just feels
well, that
like
was yesterday. That was someone reviving, or 2 days ago they revived the Apple rumor. You know, I think I said this on Twitter, and it's not an original thought. You know, every $50, we're going to get something. You know,
right.
I mean, when does the Buffett one maybe will show up at $50, right? You know, but between 50 and where it is now, 195, you know, yeah, we'll definitely see them.
One will keep coming. At 50 or 75, do you see a case for taking the company over just for the brand equity?
At 50 or $75?
Yeah.
No, I mean, call it 180 million shares. You know, you're looking at $9 billion for the equity. 11 billion for the debt, so that's
right. 20, right?
And then there's probably, I don't know, another 15 of various purchase obligations and liabilities, and then there's liabilities you don't even know what the fuck they are with these autopilot cars and the lawsuits and all that shit. I mean, there's no,
all told, you take the equity, mash it into the debt, mash it into all the liabilities. What do you think the most somebody would pay just to own the brand would be? 10 billion,
well,
15 billion?
No, are you kidding me? First of all, what's this brand worth once they immediately fire Musk, which anybody is going to do? I mean, that guy's got to go. I don't know. Maybe this brand is worth $1 billion, you know, $2 billion. And of course, you know, that's 10 or 20% of the debt, leaving zero for the equity. There's no equity value here. And the thing is, time is not on this company's side because every month that goes by, another electric car enters the market and people can say, wow, that Mercedes is really nice, you know, or that Porsche is really nice or whatever. And B, you know, every week that goes by, you're going to see, and the more these things that are on the road, you'll see more and more autopilot crashes, more and more fires, either spontaneous or crash induced, and, you know, more and more lawsuits and time and more cash burn and time is not on this company's side. Time is the enemy of this company, and everything is sort of accelerating now on the bad side for them, you know?
Yeah, well, I think you're 100% right. I think a huge wake-up call. I mean, look at what's happened over the last week. We have downgrade from Citi, or not a downgrade technically, but I think it was a lowering of the bear case price target from Citi. We got the same from Wedbush.
Well, also, by the way,
hold on. To start
ETF
the week,
cuts from Citi. Go ahead.
Okay. To start the week, we had Wedbush. Then we had Morgan Stanley. And then on this call yesterday, Jonas, okay, if you go back to May when me and you did that presentation at Whitney Tilson's thing, that was May of 2018, right? So it was 1 year ago, right?
Okay.
And I remember during that presentation making a joke about Adam Jonas and how bullish he was on Tesla, because he was really the bull that was leading the charge on Tesla really over the last 4 or 5 years. to hear that guy come on a call yesterday, and I don't know, did you hear the call audio of his investor call?
Listen,
to hear him come on that call and say, last year everything was good, the company was profitable, everybody was happy, let's look at 19. And he very matter-of-factly says, the company's burning cash again, demand has dried up, nobody cares about the Model Y, is basically exactly what he said. And then just says, you know, look, we're not looking at it as a growth story, we're looking at it as a restructuring story. I mean, that's the stock's biggest cheerleader 2 years ago turning around and saying, bankruptcy is the real option right now.
Yeah, I'm going to pay Jonas, a half compliment and half insult. Okay.
That sounds fair.
I don't think he's anywhere near as stupid as what he has said about Tesla for the last 2 or 3 years. He knows the auto industry extremely well. He's not as good as Brian Johnson at Barclays, but he's good. He understands the industry. I think he's just been a shameless whore on this thing. Looking to get financing deals, looking to get his name in the out there. I mean, he did this story, you can find it, from 2012 on Business Insider, and the headline, it was before this whole Tesla thing happened, and the headline was something like, Adam Jonas is very lonely because nobody cares about the car industry and nobody takes his calls. So at some point he said, hey, let me hitch my wagon in this Tesla thing, we'll spin a story and blah blah blah. And I think he's just been a knowledgeable whore on this stock for 3-4 years. So what am I saying there? I'm saying that at least yesterday he was honest about it, finally. He's not as stupid as he seemed to be all these years. And I think at this point he's trying to extricate himself from this and sort of salvage his career. Think of him as a whore trying to regain her virginity. That's Adam Jonas here. So, I don't think he's that dumb.
I don't think so either. I actually read something else that he wrote today on the automotive sector. I can't remember what it was, but he made some commentary about the sector as a whole. And I was like, yeah, all right, this guy seems to understand the sector. He seems to know what he's talking about. But, that's the problem with a lot of sell-side analysts and why a lot of people are choosing alternative means of getting their information. Look, if you're going out and you're investing in a stock, the last thing you want to be reading is sell side analyst reports. I read them, I read them as supplements to research that I'm doing on my own. This is why people tune into the podcast. This is why people hit you up on Twitter. This is why people read Seeking Alpha, because these are all alternatives to these sell side analysts. And
the sell side guy who has been.
The general public knew, Mark, sorry to interrupt you, but if the general public knew, and this is one of the big things. One of the big reasons I'm on Twitter, one of the big reasons I do the podcast, and one of the big things in my quote-unquote mission statement, whatever the fuck you want to call it, if the general public understood the relationship between investment banks and the way that they solicit businesses, I'm sorry, the way that they solicit business from companies, from other businesses, while they're covering them, and that, they may be seeking to do business with the company, or they may already own shares of the company, or they may be in the middle of doing a financing with the company, and they're out issuing big buy and big sell recommendations at the same time. People don't even understand that happens. The average retail investor on their Ameritrade at home clicks on the research thing, and he sees, Goldman Sachs or Fidelity. All right, let's see what they have to say, And there's a tiny little disclaimer at the bottom of it. So, we may seek to do investment banking business with the company, but that's it. And so,
and this doesn't at all negate your point, which is 100% right. Since the Blodgett settlement in the early 2000s, there is what they call a Chinese wall there, where, most of these banks, they are very strict about the research analysts not talking to the banking group. I mean, I know when I worked in banking, there was, there were literally sealed doors to keep you guys apart, and you couldn't even be in the same room with all these guys. That said, there's a wink and a nod, and I'm sure that some of the compensation for these analysts is based on the banking business, and everybody
somewhere
knows
they report
it.
To the same person. Somewhere those two divisions report. Somewhere up the hierarchy, they report to the same person.
No
it's
question.
Probably not fucking Lloyd Blankfein. But the guy maybe 3 or 4 tiers underneath them, there's a place on the hierarchical structure where people from the analysts and people from the investment banking side meet with one person, and that guy knows what's going on in both rooms.
Yep, no, definitely. Yeah, so that's what it is. Now, I should say that the one sell side analyst who has been unabashedly bearish on Tesla with by far the lowest price target on the street is Gordon Johnson from a small shop called Vertical. And Gordon is actually on Twitter, and I've met him a couple of times, and you know, we've DM'd a few times. And he's brave. He doesn't give a shit. He's happy to he'll put a sell. He'll put a short call on something. You know, no big bank ever puts a short call on. Sometimes they'll say sell. But you know, some of the other guys, you know, Brian Johnson at Barclays has been properly bearish. And you know, if you talk to some of these guys and you say, listen, you know, the stock is 300 and you know and you think this stock could be a zero, you know, why do you have a thing of 220? And they'll tell you that, you know, they're trying to figure out, they're trying to tell you where they think it'll trade in the next 6 months, not where it ultimately goes. So that's why you might see a very bearish guy with a surprisingly high price target.
Yeah, I just thought that the Jonas call was a big wake-up call. I think, you know, I can't imagine being somebody that pays for his research and reading everything that he's written over the last couple of years and then, you know, being invited to that call. And I also find the timing of the call with the financing that they just performed weird. I mean, when was the last time you saw an investment bank go out and do a $2 billion financing for a company and then turn around and just take a shit on it?
Yeah, literally 2.5 weeks later. I mean, you know, there are a number of theories about that. You know, was it forced internally? Was it a way of covering their asses? Did Musk do something to piss them off? Who knows? You know, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, one thing, by the way, we should tell people out there who don't actually work on the street is big buy side guys, institutional investors, very few of them put any credence at all in what these sell side guys have to say.
Correct.
They basically pay for the research either via commissions or directly in order to get easier access to management teams. You know, the way these guys get paid is they get paid for setting up meetings, essentially. But you know, all you're doing there is, and this is, you know, you're setting yourself up to have, I got the inside scoop. I got a meeting with the IR guy at Tesla. He's just fucking gonna lie to you, like they've lied for years and years. I mean, you know, Ron Barron is the funniest. Oh, I got a factory tour, and this is happening. And guess what, Ron? That actually didn't happen. So you're basically paying money to be deceived by a lying management team. I don't see any advantage in that either.
You know who else got a factory tour was the people that invested in the Chinese reverse mergers like 8 years ago. You know, they turned the lights on at the factory. They turned the fountains on outside. They bust.
Yeah, it turned out to be somebody else's factory. Actually.
Yeah, it was either that or as soon as they fed them and put them back on their merry way, they turned everything back off again.
Exactly. So anyway, look, it is what it is. I mean, look, better that Jonas tells the truth now, you know, than never.
Right.
So I'll give him credit for that. And I'm also giving him credit for being smarter than he seemed over the last few years. But I think it was pretty immoral what he did if he was that smart, you know.
Yeah. And he may be towing a line between his own cognitive dissonance and what he's expected to produce,
you know what?
Where he works.
Then leave. Don't say, oh, I have this great sell side job. This is what I have to do. Fuck it. Go do something else.
Hey, you know what? I would agree with you 100%. And that's the reason that I'm not writing, you know, reports for an investment bank or working on the sell side or working for AXA Equitable Advisors.
That and the tattoos.
Yeah. Well, you can cover those up though. You know what I mean? But I've gotten offers, you know, to work at places like that, not Goldman Sachs, but to work at places where I felt like, you know, my kind of personal view would not align with the company's view. And I'm not interested in trying entertain that and to try to be somebody that I'm not, which is why I'm here, you know, cursing with you on a podcast while I'm drinking a beer instead of sitting in an office getting shrieked at by somebody, you know.
Doing lines of coke.
Yeah, way, well, exactly. I mean, you can't imagine. I always tweet out, you know, like some junior broker somewhere is getting fucking screamed at right now.
Yeah, well, listen, that's one of the reasons I left investment banking. I mean, as an investment banker, your job is to tell every potential client that they're beautiful and you want to raise the money, and then you go out and tell the investors, hey, this company's beautiful and you should invest in this deal and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I mean, when I did it, I was dealing with sophisticated institutions, and these were often structured deals and they were hedged and everyone knew exactly what was up. But I still got tired of doing it. I'm very selective. I invest or short maybe one out of several hundred things that I look at.
Right.
So I don't want to go out there and my job being raising money for, you know, everything I look at. It's just so, you know, anyway, that's just the way
it works. And telling everybody that everything that you're looking at is great. You know, you're telling the company, hey, I'm going to get you a great deal, and then turn around telling investors, hey, I'm going to get you a great deal. It's like somebody's getting fucked there, especially when the third party's getting paid.
If I didn't think something was great, I would never tell them I thought it was great. And they wouldn't listen to me anyway. These were sophisticated guys. But I would say, look, here's the company's story. Here's what they say. And, you know, and that's it. And I would not personally endorse any of this stuff, you know, so.
Right. But the point is, it's a zero-sum game, right? Either the shareholders are paying the price through whatever, the dilution or the warrant coverage that you're offering or whatever, or you're just selling a shit deal, you know, that benefits the company and doesn't benefit the investors.
Yeah, and, you know, look, I was at relatively small banks, and we dealt with relatively small companies, and, you know, these were companies that, you know, as I said, a lot of structured deals, and, you know, so nobody got hurt on these deals. They were all hedged and everything else, and the companies knew it. That was the only way they could get money. That's, by the way, what Tesla is headed for. You know, I mean, that convert deal was a sample of that, basically. I mean, you notice the equity portion was very small, and a chunk of that probably had to do with the convert deal, right? So it's just going to get worse and worse for them. The deals will be increasingly ugly and structured. You know,
yeah, here's a question maybe you can answer for me. There was included in, I think, the prospectus for that deal when they filed it, when they closed it, something called like a $400 million note hedge. Do you know what that is?
Well, what they did, what Tesla did was they did a call spread, and they essentially bought a call at the strike price of the convert, which mm-hmm. was whatever, $300 and something, and then they sold a call with a strike price of, you know, I believe it was $600 and something.
Okay.
So they were essentially hedged against dilution for anywhere between the 300 and whatever figure and the 600 and whatever dollar
figure.
Now,
wouldn't they be hedged above 600? Isn't that
no above 600? You know, they don't above 600. The thing would convert, but they're safe on the in between.
Got it. So the point was
they sold the $600 whatever call.
Yeah, and they bought the other one. Okay, you said the opposite. That's why
I thought
the other way.
Okay,
I thought you said they right, because otherwise it would mean over 600. Then they would be okay.
Right. Yeah. So, and by the way, the whole thing was idiotic. A couple of guys wrote a great letter about it. Glenn Tong, who I know, who's a very sophisticated guy. He ran an investment bank at one point, wrote about how much this cost Tesla. I mean, the cost to this dummy of a CFO was just egregious. I mean, the Goldman guys just, you know, basically raped this kid. And and the whole thing is stupid anyway, because here's the thing. Musk is obsessed with the concept of dilution. And it's for a few reasons. One is, you know, he wants to maintain control of the company. Another one is he probably in his little fourth grade poker playing mind thinks it's a signaling to the market that they think there's a real chance they could be diluted otherwise. Like, oh yeah, I think the stock could trade at $400 or $500 a share, and I don't want to sell shares at that cheap price, right? So I'm going to hedge it, right?
And another reason is probably it's one of those things that fucking longs that don't understand anything always talk about. Is there going to be dilution? Is it dilution? There's no dilution.
Right. Well,
we got to stop dilution.
Yeah, right. So signaling is it's a lot of signaling, I think, is what it is. So, you know, so that's why that happened. And, you know, again, he's all about the show and the scam and the promote. And any smart guy would have said, you know what, the stock's at 244, wherever it is, and this thing converts at over 300. If it happens, it happens. We need the $400 million in our pocket, more importantly now, right?
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, that's Tesla for you. It's just a joke.
Well, looking forward now with the stock now trading with 100 handle, I mean, what do you think is the next catalyst? What does tomorrow look like to you? What does next week look like? What does next month look like? I mean, I know you play the long game, right?
So, like, I do play the long game, and, you know, I selectively add, or if I have to take a little off on news, I'll take a little off. So, who knows what the next catalyst on the calendar, you know, is the is the report of, well, the estimates for May U.S. sales and actual European numbers that come in, you know, early in June. And then the next catalyst on the calendar after that are the official June delivery, official Q2 number delivery numbers, which come in early in June. But there's a catalyst every fucking day with this scam. I mean, who knows? You know, I think there's a real chance that if it's not the NHTSA, then it's maybe the German equivalent, you know, somebody in Europe who says enough is enough, we're banning this thing.
You think, you know, if an international regulator does that, that the U.S. will have to follow suit?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know what would make the U.S. follow suit of anything, but it would be a real situation, you know, if an international guy did it. I mean, you know, people would think twice, and who knows, you know, I don't know. But so that's a catalyst that can happen at any time, and anything else can happen at any time, right? I mean, there was a report yesterday that they asked some of their suppliers to allow terms up to 120 days.
I saw that too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe somebody goes COD on them. There was a rumor about that today, but it wasn't confirmed, so I didn't even retweet it. But, you know, that can happen. You know, all kinds. Listen, I think, I don't know, I guess we haven't spoken really since the last offering. You know, on the back of my envelope, I think that if they spend what they said they would spend on CapEx this year, and obviously it has to be very back-end loaded because they spent almost nothing in Q1, I think these guys would be 100% completely out of cash at the beginning of Q4. And even if they don't spend the CapEx, I think they are 100% completely out of cash, you know, on December 31st or sometime around there, early January. So I think they have to do another – and by the way, the reason for that is – if you look at the end of Q1, the accounts payable absolutely soared relative to Q1 revenue, which means they were delaying paying people. So my thought is that, like, the minute this wire hit from the $2.3 billion or whatever it was they raised, they probably immediately got calls from every stretched out supplier.
Oh, of course.
And they probably had to send out $2 billion in checks or wires or whatever.
I worked at a company where that happened, where we were just waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to close money. And then we did a $10 million financing, and all of a sudden it was like the fucking 4th of July with the phones.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, and I suspect strongly that happened with Tesla. And that's why I think they're completely out of money at year end, and that's why I think they're gonna have to do another big financing next quarter in Q3, and it's gonna be.
And what does that financing look like now?
Well, it's gonna be uglier than this one.
Not only with the equity price where it is, but also, Mark, everybody kind of looking back and saying, "Well, what happened after the last financing? Well, those guys were fucked in probably 3.2 seconds after they signed the documents. The stock was trading 20% lower."
Right. Well, the next financing, you know, would probably be like, you know, heavily discounted common stock, or, you know, maybe an at the money convert, or a convert, you know, with a up 5 or up 10, a 5% higher strike price for 10%. Maybe like something even uglier. Maybe a resettable convert. You know, a potential death spiral convert. I don't know. I mean, this company now,
all of those situations result in the equity going down.
Correct. That's correct. Yeah. I mean, the best hope for them, if you were really a bull on this company, would be for them to, you know, just sell a ton of equity, even if it's at a 10 or 12% discount, and, you know, hope that they can turn it around. But they can't turn it around. I mean, they're running headlong into Mercedes-Benz and Porsche later this year. And then next year, they're running into two more models from Audi and, you know, and the Volvo Polestar 2, which is a direct competitor for the Model 3. And they're running into all these cars at a time that their sales are basically flatlined, right? They're basically stalled out. So there's only so much market share there. I mean, governments are trying to force, you know, a bigger share for electric cars, right? China has sort of its own ZEV credit system that kicks in next year. And of course, Europe is trying to force it. So, you know, the EV market will grow, but I don't think the EV market will grow as fast as the supply of EVs coming around, you know?
And how long are governments going to, you know, incentivize these things? I mean, it's just...
It
was supposed to be a one-time deal, right?
You've got carrots and you've got sticks, okay? The carrot is in the U.S., the $7,500 tax credit, which of course gets halved, which Tesla's now halved and then halved again and then goes away. Or in Norway, it's whatever. Like, I don't know exactly how it works, but it's like 100% credit on the value-added tax and all kind. You know, it basically almost halves the price of the car, right? So those are the carrots. The sticks are the system that's going in place in China, which is sort of like the California one, where car companies have to sell a certain amount of, you know, non-emissions cars, or they have to buy credits for those cars. I mean, that was this deal that Fiat Chrysler, you know, made with Tesla to pay them, you know, it looks like an average of about $167 million a quarter for 3 years until they have enough of their own electric cars so they don't have to buy them anymore, right? But even that number, by the way, is very dependent on Tesla sales. And right now, Tesla sales are hugely disappointing in Europe, which would imply that Fiat Chrysler is going to wind up paying Tesla a lot less than the number that was quoted, and Tesla's going to get a lot less than that number that was quoted, you know?
Did you see that one of the so there were two people that defended the company over the last 2 days, one of which was Bank of America, who came out with what I thought was the stupidest thing I had ever read.
Okay? Yeah, so
Bank of America came out and said, basically, now that the stock is lower, there's, you know, you're at risk of a short squeeze, which was the funniest thing since I read Ross Gerber's tweet this morning trying to explain how short selling works, which I almost literally pissed myself and fell off my chair reading. It was so funny. And then you also had Mr. Melissa Lee also. Ben Callow was out a couple days ago saying, what the hell did he say?
Well, he slashed his price target a lot from 400 to 340.
Oh, did he? I didn't see that.
Yeah, yeah. And then he said, you know, I think he tried to sound like George Soros. And he said he said something like, maybe he didn't use this word, some reflexivity here, where the lower the stock goes, the less people will believe the story. I don't know. It's just something really fucking stupid. So there was that. But, you know, the B of A guy, John Murphy. So the guy who originally covered Tesla at B of A is a young guy named John Lovello, who was terrifically smart. You could pull up his old notes. I have a lot of them. He saw right through Musk's bullshit, coincidentally around the same time I was getting short this thing in 2013 and 14. He was writing a lot of that stuff, and he's a good guy. I met him a couple of times. I haven't seen him in years. Actually, it's funny. So they switched him out of Tesla years ago, and he's covering the housing sector. And actually, I'm going to try to get together with him sometime soon because he's just a good guy in general. Anyway, when they switched him out, this guy John Murphy, whom I've never met, came in. And Murphy generally has been very good. I mean, he's been skeptical for a while. He had one of the lower targets on the street and all that. And that's why this was very out of character for him to write, you know, such a stupid note, you know. everything about this company sucks, but, you know, they could have a short squeeze. What if Elon comes up with a new product line? it's ridiculous.
I think Musk's wink tweet 2 days ago, or was it yesterday? I think his tweet where, you know, he winked, I think was an allusion to that email going out, because dated 10 o'clock last night. And I think that he may have thought like, oh, this is going to stop the bleeding. But if what you're saying is right, and really this is what looks to be the case, it looks to be that the market is losing confidence in Musk's ability to just tell the truth. And once they start to doubt him and these little pumps, you know, hey, it saved you maybe from a $10 sell-off today, but I don't think the stock was green. It's certainly not over, you know, meaningfully. It's not over 200 again. You know, these things used to provide big boosts to the share price, and they're not doing shit now. And that's a huge problem, because you also have the factor of the more he tries to do this, the more obvious it's going to become that he's just trying to pump, right?
Right. So to your credit, because I saw your tweet, you saw that wink, and you said you actually were buying some calls to hedge your position because you were wondering kind of what he had up his sleeve. I don't know if that's to your credit or not. I mean, it is to your credit that you recognized there was a pump coming. Maybe it wasn't to your credit that you thought it would.
Well, I have long dated puts, so I just hedged out on some ultra cheap short dated
calls.
That's
fine. And to your credit, you spotted that, and I didn't even recognize it as a wink. I mean, I don't know my emojis. To me, it looked like a what can I do face, you know? The stock's getting killed and my hands are tied here, you know, my hands are tied by the fence and there's nothing I can do. So, but you nailed it. Obviously that was what he was hinting at. And you know, a friend of mine pointed out that he actually seemed to have fired that off exactly when his plane was taking off from from whatever airport he uses up there, Van Nuys or whatever. So, you know, you have that guy on Twitter who tracks his planes, you know. So, you know, he probably sat there and thinking, okay, what can I do? Oh, yeah, I'll do this, and fired it off. And that, you know, that was his wink, you know, that was coming. So whatever. Who fucking cares? This guy is such a $3 bill. You know, this thing in Vegas is so funny, right? What did he bid? $50 million, something like that, to build a mile-long tunnel with 150-mile electric cars and all underground cars and all this shit? Come get the fuck out of here. That thing is going to run out of money when it's like 5%
before they break ground. I know.
When it's like 5% of the way done.
I know.
And, you know, and then you know, then you could take that hole and give it to Joe Pesci from Casino, and he can stick some bodies in there, because that's all it's going to be good for. And meanwhile, this, like, whatever, this 100-year-old German company that's built monorails all around the world, you know, bid, you know, somewhat more and said, yeah, we'll get this job done, and the other guy won't be able to do it for that. And you know, listen, I don't know if Musk...
They think Musk actually has a plan. They think the Boring Company is a real company with a real plan that really knows what they're doing. I mean, you know, this German company, I don't know anything about them, but I'm sure they're like 150 years old, and they specialize in monorails and subways, and they have real engineers. And, like, you know, this guy's going to be there with a bunch of fucking, you know, shovels digging a hole in the ground, trying, you know, it's just, they're not even going to be on a par with one another, man. They're not even going to be on a par, you know, for probably $10 or $15 million more, whatever the German company bid, they could have a real functional subway or a real functional monorail that could actually ferry passengers back and forth to certain places in Las Vegas. And what you're going to get now is you're going to get a disaster. If they even break ground on this, it's going to be a disaster. I don't know how anybody can watch that video of him going through the tunnel with that fucking car ping-ponging around like he's bumper bowling underground. I don't know how anybody can watch that and go, oh, well, yeah, here's a great engineering team, right? Are you kidding me? I wouldn't let them fucking replace the flooring in my house.
Chris, I see so many incredibly stupid decisions by municipalities around the country, around the world.
Of course.
You know, for this guy. Remember, that, like, there was the Chicago thing, and there's the L.A. thing where, you know, and then there's the New York, the Washington, the Baltimore thing. And, you know, some of it is him bullshitting, but then there's a press conference, and the local municipalities say, yeah, we're trying to work with them to get this done. Listen, I don't know if it's campaign contributions, right? I don't know if it's blackmail, or I don't know if it's just incredibly
probably
fucking
just idiots
or incredibly fucking stupid politicians. I don't know. I mean, I would not put any of those. I would not eliminate any of those three as a possibility.
Listen,
Musk has these security teams he hires. You know, we know about them. A lot of people know about them. He tries to dig stuff up on people. I mean, there was nothing to find on me because I think we've talked about it. I'm just a really fucking boring guy off of Twitter. I mean, in real life, I'm a fucking loser. So, you know, some of these people may actually live interesting lives, and who knows? I have no idea. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just throwing it out there.
At some point, Mark. At some point, somebody. I'm guessing it's going to be Aaron at Plainsight because he's got a knack for these things. Somebody's going to FOIA the exact amount of due diligence that Las Vegas did in making their decision, aside from pointing to the bid on a sheet of paper, going, that number's lower than this one. We better go with that one. And at some point, somebody's going to want to know, yeah, well, what other due diligence did you do from an engineering perspective?
Well,
the answer is going to be fuck all, okay? And then just to go back to your other thing about Musk with the security teams, all right? It just made me think of that article that was out like 2 months ago where he supposedly ran out of the Fremont factory. Somebody went to collect their belongings after they were fired or after
they
resigned.
Yeah, they escorted him out or whatever.
And Musk ran out after him. You know, don't come back. Don't ever fucking come back.
No, he said he was going to nuke him.
Oh,
I'm going to
nuke him. Right. As he's probably surrounded by, you know, 3 or 4 6-foot-10 cock diesel security guards.
I'm not talking about, you know, personal bodyguards.
I know, you're talking about intelligence firms, right?
I'm talking about, like, you know, things like, what's that Israeli company, Black Cube, something along those lines, you know? So, you know, look, it was interesting on this Vegas thing. I did see it. I didn't follow it closely, but I did see an article where the mayor of Vegas, Her name is Goodman. I forget her first name, but her husband was the mayor before, Oscar Goodman. Oscar Goodman was a very sharp, you know, really mob lawyer in Vegas for many years before he ran for mayor. I mean, you know, it's like a guy like, yeah, he knows where the bodies are buried. Oscar right. You know, probably literally knew
knows where the bodies are buried.
But he was a great mayor, a street smart, you know, sharp guy who, by all everything I can tell, did an excellent job as mayor of Vegas. And I assume his wife is probably doing just as good a job. You know, maybe they're working on it together or whatever. And she said, like, wait a second here. There's no track record from Musk. What he has right. is sketchy. You know, she's smart. She's street smart, like her husband. So I don't know exactly how her desire got overridden. Maybe the mayor in Vegas, you know, some of these times, some of these places, essentially more of a ceremonial position than anything, and maybe the council really runs things. I don't know. But to her credit, the mayor said, well, hold on here. But, she nobody cared, you know.
I'm going to nuke you. Hold me back, guys. Hold me back. If it weren't for my three bodyguards holding me back, I would totally kick your ass.
right, yeah. So, you know what? There's a lot of books being written about this, and there are a lot of people involved. And look, it's falling apart now, but when it really falls apart and it's over, a lot of stuff will come out of the woodwork, and a lot of this stuff will be explained, and I'll be like, yeah, we kind of figured there had to be something like that going on, right? And that's what's going to happen.
Do you know how much money I have? Do you know who I am?
Do you know who I am? You have to let me into that nightclub.
Yeah, right.
Let me into that Met costume ball. Do you know who I am?
That'll be it.
Right. Well,
exactly.
Right now, people know who he is, but he wasn't at the Met ball this year.
Who cares?
I don't know if you noticed. Yeah,
I don't even know what the Met Ball is.
It's this huge costume party where all these celebs kind of show off crazy outfits. This year it was the craziest because the theme was camp, as in, you know, campy kind of outfits. And, you know, Anna Wintour, who used to run Vogue, and still, I guess, is a Condé Nast, she handpicks everybody, and, you know, it's a big ego trip for everybody. And it's a fundraiser, but my guess is that none of the celebrities – buy tickets. I mean, tickets were like 25 grand. I'm sure they sit at tables that corporate sponsors pay for.
I have a bar around the corner from my house, okay, where right now there's a big, hairy, disgusting guy with a beard, chain-smoking Marlboro Reds and drinking Budweiser bottles, and I'd rather be sitting next to that fucking guy than at this. I mean, it sounds like the editor from Vogue rounding up everybody I've tried to avoid my whole life and getting them all into the same room.
You know, I would like to go to that.
So you can listen to George Clooney tell you about how you should vote, right?
Well, you know, if I went to that thing, I would be taking pictures of all these people and then just mocking them on Twitter. I would be tweeting the pictures with just total mock, and that's why I would only go once. I would be like, you know, before he sort of became establishment, you know, that's what Howard Stern would do, right? He would go to one of these things and kind of be the outsider making fun of these people. Now he's apparently the insider. So, you know, he's got this new book out, which like is like some of his favorite interviews over the years, and he's right. been kind of promoting it, and he's been saying how embarrassed he is about, you know, all the fart jokes he used to do and the sex jokes, and, you know, how he's ashamed of all that stuff, and, you know, I don't know if he really is or what. But
well, I can pick that baton up where he leaves it if he's embarrassed. Let me just say, I'm certainly not embarrassed by it.
I'm happy to make jokes like that, and I'm not that much younger now than Howard is today. I think he's 10 years older than I am or something, and I'm certainly older than he was when he was doing those jokes. So
he has some of the best interviews in history of all time, his show, man. Before it even, like, you know, it went commercial, after he was on E, even there was good stuff then, and like, but I mean, if you go back a ways, man, his stuff was just fantastic. It really was.
I haven't heard Howard in years and years because I don't drive to work anymore. Now, okay, so I first heard Howard when I was working on – I don't know if we talked about this story. When I was working on my college radio station in 1983. Did I tell you this story?
No.
He was on WNBC AM in New York.
WNBC.
How did you know that, actually? That's funny because you're a Philly guy. They just brought him up from D.C. He actually got fired from D.C. after that plane crash. You know that story, right?
D.C. 101, right? Wasn't it?
Well, DC 101, and right. apparently some plane had crashed into a bridge, whatever, the 110th Street Bridge, whatever it is. And so Stern, you know, on the air, calls up the airline and says, yeah, I'd like to know when the next flight is to the 110th Street Bridge, or, you know, can I book a seat? And whatever it was, And, you know, it was really too soon, right?
Right.
So, because for Howard, it was probably 5 minutes after the crash.
Right, right.
So anyway, so they fired him, but he was a huge ratings guy. They were NBC, and I heard him, and I'm like, this is God I'm listening to here. I mean, he was the original. I mean, he was really the original. They used to call him a shock jock, but he wasn't. It was smart, shocking humor. And,
right.
And so I just fell in love with this guy, with what he was doing. So I started calling into the show, and I was a weekly regular from my radio station calling into his show. Like, Wednesday afternoons, we did these things called rank outs when, you know, we'd insult each other's mothers or whatever. And they invited me down to the studio, and I was up in Ithaca, New York, so it was a trip. It was like a 4.5-hour trip. But I came down to the studio and did it live with them once, and it was really a great experience. So I'm – but – you know, and then I heard him when he went to FM. He was on K-Rock in the probably late 80s through the 90s. And then when I left my real estate company, I was just not in a car anymore. That was in 2000.
Right.
So I literally have not heard him since 2000. I haven't heard any of his satellite stuff or anything. It's been 19 years since I've heard the guy.
It's funny how I kind of like backed into listening to him too, which was when I was, you know, years ago, two decades ago or whatever, back when they were trying to figure out, you know, where to fucking roll Imus's bones somewhere, and he wound up doing Imus in the Morning on, you know, telecast. He was doing it on, before he was on Fox News, he was doing it somewhere else. Can't remember where it was. I think he was on two stations in the morning. And I used
Talking to about
be,
Imus?
Yeah, I used to flip through the cable news station. I think this was in high school or before high school even.
I would see
this guy on in the morning, and it was Imus in the Morning. You couldn't fucking understand a word the guy was. You couldn't understand a fucking word the guy was saying. He looked like he was ready to just fall out of his chair. And I just kept wondering, like, what the fuck is this? Like, who's tuning in to watch this? And maybe I was 17 years old, 16, 19, who knows? Like, what is this? Who is tuning in to watch this guy? You know, and then I found out who Imus was. Then I found out about the feud. So I went back, and then when YouTube came around, I started listening to all the old Howard Stern versus Imus, you know, rants back and forth when they would get on each other's air and they would insult each other. And it was just, it was incredible. I mean, Stern just beat the shit out of him.
Well, when Howard came to New York and did those afternoons on NBC, Imus was the morning man on NBC. And by then, even by then, 1983, however many years ago that was, 36 years ago, whatever, Imus was already kind of washed up, phoning it in, lazy, and not very funny anymore. I mean, Imus was funny like in the 70s, you know, he would make prank phone calls.
The 1870s?
No, you know, and then Imus was, I think, very jealous of Howard, because Howard was much funnier, getting a lot more attention, getting much better ratings, at least in terms of share. You know, maybe overall ratings might have been bigger because Morning Drive is bigger than the Afternoon Drive, and Imus was Morning Drive. I don't know. But anyway, so Imus just gave Howard a really hard time. I mean, Howard did not, I don't think, start off by giving Imus a hard time. And then, of course, you know, Howard became much bigger star than Imus and biggest star in, you know, in media, really. I mean, what's the guy paid by satellite? Like $100 million a year or something?
Yeah.
Some incredible amount of money, right?
Yeah,
so, you know, good for him. I mean, listen, people don't appreciate how incredibly talented Howard is. I mean, when I would do college radio and I had heard him, I would try to do, you know, like a 3-4 hour freeform show with playing very little music. It's unbelievably hard to be entertaining and funny every day of the week for 3 or 4 hours a day.
Oh, yeah,
in fact,
absolutely.
There's like one person in the world who can do it, and that's Howard, you know? So I have all the admiration for that guy. And by the way, I'll tell you something interesting. And he actually even talks about this in promoting his book now. When I saw him in the studio, you know, he was all this crazy, typical Howard stuff, and then the mic would turn off, and like commercial spots would be playing, and he was like this nice, you know, mild-mannered guy. At that point, he had two young daughters or whatever. He was commuting in from Long Island, and he was like this regular guy at a barbecue somewhere on Long Island. And then the commercials would end, and the mic would turn on, and you'd hear the Howard that you know on the radio. And it's not that the Howard you know on the radio was phony. It was like he figured out how to remove all the filters, right? So, and the reason he's so successful is he says everything that your average guy is thinking,
right?
But filters it. You know, the average guy either filters it, he doesn't say it, or he even just filters it from his own brain. Like, oh, I shouldn't think that about her. I shouldn't wonder this about her. Howard just it just comes right up from his gut and pours out of his mouth into the microphone. Like, that's the real Howard. That's not a phony Howard.
And it's important too, if you want to try and, you know, spearhead new ground in an industry, right? Or you want to be the first person to kind of move into uncharted territory, you have to do that, right? You have to. And that's what ultimately will make you the leader, regardless of whether or not Imus was a shock jock before him or not. You know, that's why Imus
I don't know that it was a exactly deliberate choice. Like, Howard just followed his own path.
Right.
You know, he just came back. He's like, this is what I'm going to do. Fuck it. This comes natural to me. If people find it funny, great. I hope they do. I'll have a huge career. And of course they did. And he did, you know.
And to some degree too, you know, you wind up sometimes forced in that situation. And I'm certainly never going to compare myself to Howard Stern. But when I think about why I'm here and why I'm doing the podcast the way that I'm doing it, is because I could not get on, you know, CNBC. I was not invited to Yahoo Finance back after they brought me on once and I didn't shut the fuck up for a half hour. I wouldn't stop talking. You know what I mean? Like, and so finally you just say, fine. Like, and I just put this out there, you know, and I don't expect people to like it and I don't want anybody to care, you know, and if you do, that's great. And I'm stoked on that. But otherwise, you just, you know, you have to do that at some point. And the interesting thing, too, is I saw somebody the other day. I found this interesting, and I'm not attributing this to me at all, but I just found this very interesting. Somebody who is an influencer in the financial media world who has a lot of followers on Twitter. A lot. Put something.
What is an influencer? I think of influencers like, you know, they wear makeup and get teenage girls to buy their shit.
All right, let's say somebody who's very well known in the financial media. Is that better?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, somebody who's very well known in the financial media, has a lot of Twitter followers, put out a tweet a couple of days ago with a curse word in it, and that said something very similar to something that I had said, you know, at some point.
So he's ripping off your
ex. No, I'm not accusing anybody of ripping anything off. I'm not. Because, you know, there's some ego involved. They have to be like, oh, he's listening to me. And I don't think he is listening to me.
The F word. Yeah. Right.
No, but I just found it interesting. And I was like, all right, you know. So I went back and checked. I searched his Twitter feed to see if he had made any similar comment in the past or if he had ever used that word before in the past. And of course he hadn't. I was like, oh, all right, you know, that's an interesting coincidence. I'm going to keep my eyes open for any other interesting coincidences. So that's
It could just be that you have lowered the bar.
I hope
for acceptable social behavior. You know, the way, like, in a lot of ways, Trump has lowered the bar for, you know, without getting political. I'm not talking policy here, but, you know, with the insults. I mean, what presidential candidate before him ever came along with these insults and just flaunted regulations and didn't give a fuck, you know? So it's like he's lowered the bar for everybody, you know? Now some of the Democrats are insulting him back.
Well, if I lower the bar, that's just a bonus, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no,
I mean,
listen,
let's let everybody in. But the point of the matter is you can't get any fucking reality in financial news media. All right, now with regular political media, you have the, you know, all these people that are out there starting their own independent projects on the left and on the right. Everybody's got a newspaper, you know, but Ben Shapiro has a newspaper, you know, the Breitbart's out there, there's the Raw Story on the left, you know, so everybody's kind of covering that spectrum. But in the world of finance, you just don't get any kind of variety. Everything, whether you get it from Fox Business News, or you get it from CNBC, or you get it from Bloomberg, is coated in this fucking lacquer of bullshit and nonsense and jargon and, you know, just the acceptable indoctrination of the way that the system works. And nobody's really broken through and so when you start to learn some of this stuff, right? I don't know anything, Mark, but like when I first start to learn things about how these deals are done, all right, and like, you know, why certain things are called certain things in the financial world and just how the fucking system works, you're like, oh my god, like, how is nobody fucking talking about this?
Well, you know, for the most part, other than like the rare investigative financial reporter, like the guy from the Journal who did Theranos or the gal who did Enron. You know, financial media tends to be reactive, not proactive, right? You know, when did I want the Tesla bear on? and the stock is completely tanking.
Right.
You know, you go on when it's 350 and they make fun of you and look at you like an asshole and don't want you back on again. So, and now, like, you look at Squawk Box in the morning and they're like, oh, you know, the attitude is almost like, oh, yeah, we saw this coming a mile away, right? We noticed the whole time. Yeah. Right?
Tim Seymour, so, Scott Wapner put out a tweet there and he's like, Tim Seymour called it. I'm like, Tim Seymour.
Well, Tim Seymour, by the way, Tim Seymour did call it.
When?
He's been short. Tim Seymour has been short for a while.
Like, has he? Well, like, then I'm an asshole then.
I don't know if he top-ticked it, but he certainly was short, you know, like last fall, you know, right near the top of the most recent move and all through this crap. Tim made a great call here, and to his credit, he did it with Mr. Ben Callow. You know, was the host of that 5 p.m. show, you know, Melissa Callow or, you know, Ben.
Well, then I'm an asshole then for not knowing that. I often shoot first an and ask questions.
No, but Tim.
But there's
Tim
just
been
so many people. There's so many other people that he could have attributed a congratulatory, you know, you being one of those people, one of the first people.
So you're referring to him the other day? Is that what you're talking about?
No,
on Twitter?
No. What I'm saying is that it was Scott Wapner's choice to turn around and say, great job, Tim Seymour.
Oh, look, you know, he's complimenting someone who works with him and is on the air. You know, people said the other day, Tim Seymour tweeted something about Tesla, and somebody said, oh, well, what about all these TSLAQ people? And he said, listen, I said right away, I said, look, I don't give a fuck if I get credit or not. I don't get paid on credit. You know, my LPs, my funds don't get credit on credit. I am thrilled, you know, I mean, here I'm on your show here and, you know, we're talking to 11 people. I'm thrilled to see, I'm thrilled to see Tim Seymour taking, understanding the short case here and broadcasting it to all 500 people who still watch CNBC.
Wow.
Right? So I'm happy about that. I have no problem with that. And I don't really care if he says where it came from. And look, Tim's a smart guy. He's just absorbing a lot of different information out there the same way you and I are absorbing a lot of different. I mean, listen, sure. I didn't invent the fact that Tesla's going to have a lot of competition, right? You know, all these people can see the same thing that you and I are seeing. They're equally smart, and it's just right in our faces. And so, you know, Tim saw it too. That's fine. I have no problem with that.
Yeah, well, I think I still have beef with him just from the Fleckenstein thing from a couple of years ago. Maybe it's time to let that go.
But you know what? To his credit, I think I saw that. I haven't watched that show in so long, but I think I did see that. Or, you know, I saw maybe with Peter Schiff, which was probably the same thing. I think I saw both, which is like, he's like, listen, you know, you've been saying this for a long time, and I'm paraphrasing Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, and conceptually, you're probably right, and one day you will be right in fact, but in the meantime, our job is to make money in the markets. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think the flip side of that, it should be Fleckenstein and Peter Schiff saying, you know, you're right. I'm making a long-term call. It's not a short-term call. And maybe these stocks will go up, and I'm not the right guy if that's what you're looking for. I mean, that's how that thing should have happened. I don't know why it didn't happen that way, you know?
I don't know either, but...
I mean, Seymour's not wrong in saying... I mean, first of all, of all places to be on that stupid show called Fast Money, you know, I mean, that's like a short-term trading thing. I mean, Peter Schiff... as right as he might be over the next five decades, and same thing with Bill Fleckenstein. By the way, Fleckenstein is at least acknowledges that. Fleckenstein,
right?
You know, is happy to say, "Hey, I don't want to be short here because I'm afraid of the money printing or whatever." I mean, I don't know him, but I'm just, you know. So at least, you know, Seymour is like, that's all very well and good, but our job on Fast Money is, you know, what's going to happen in the markets this week,
right?
And that's fine. It's just a matter of different time frames, you know.
Yeah, and Peter certainly Schiff, I think the thesis actionable. That we're going to see hyperinflation from the currency collapsing is a multi-decade or, you know, multi-century-long thesis.
I mean, look at how long Japan has been able to print money, and it still has an inflation rate of, you know, in a quote-unquote good month, 1%,
right?
So this shit can go on a lot longer than any of us thought. I mean, everybody who said when the Fed introduced QE1 or QE2 – hyperinflation, you know? These economies are aircraft carriers. They're battleships. They turn very slowly over very long periods of time, you know? So, you know, it's funny, actually. I was having a discussion with a smart friend of mine, another hedge fund guy, about David Tepper, because you saw the story today about how Tepper is converting to a family office.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different factors there. One factor is he bought the football team. The other factor is he's 62 and he's a gazillionaire. And what does he need this for if he's tired of it? Another factor might be, I don't know his social life, but, you know, I do know he got divorced at some point. Maybe he just wants to be single. I don't know if he got remarried since then or whatever. But that's all fine. But the other thing could just be he's basically calling the top, right? And the brilliant call that Tepper made, and it's why I had dinner with him with a group dinner a few years ago. We didn't really get to talk much, but I told him then, the reason I admire him so much is he went on CNBC in 2010, and when all the perma bulls were saying, oh, the economy is going to boom, you know, we had the recession, it's over, and the spring back is always, you know, the spring back is as strong as the downdraft, right? So we're going to have the season. Tepper guy, he said, listen, I'm paraphrasing. He said, listen, I don't know if this economy is going to get better or not, but if it doesn't, but if it does, stocks will go up, right? And if it doesn't, the Fed is, and I'm paraphrasing, the Fed is going to print so much goddamn money that they'll push stocks up. Right. So I want to be balls to the wall long, right, because I'm not going to lose here. And you know what? He was fucking right. So, I did very well in, 2010, 2011. I might have had a down year in 12, but a huge year in 13. The whole time, I was bearish. I just haven't defined super cheap, deep value kind of nano cap stocks that were cheap under any circumstances, and they went up a lot, and I made a lot of money for myself and my LPs. But I was dead wrong about how good the economy would be and what effect Fed money printing would have. And Tepper was right for the right reasons.
And I think that it's only, you are only allowed to kind of take that argument and run with it, which is, it's a win-win. Because if the economy recovers, stocks are going to go up. That's a win. And if the economy falters, the Fed's going to bail us out. You can only make that argument and really push that as an argument that doesn't have any moral hazard now. Looking forward versus when that gate swings the other direction, when that tide turns, which it may never happen, but it may happen. And I think it's important to just always put out the other part, the other half of that argument.
Yeah,
because
how
many times has something broken, Mark, whether it's the fucking housing market or the banking system or the dot-com, when we're standing on the other side of it going, how come fucking nobody said anything and how come nobody saw that this was going
to
happen?
But if you said that to David Tepper in 2010 when he went on CNBC and said all that stuff, I think it was maybe – I'm not sure. And he went on there talking about his charity, and then he talked about the market at the same time. So maybe it was Christmas time, 2010. I don't remember. Anyway, if you said that to him, obviously Tepper's a fucking smart guy. He would have said, you know, Chris, you're absolutely right, but that day is not today, and that day is not for the next 5 years.
How do we know that? Yes, Tepper got this call right, but
I'll tell you how you know. The way you know is that this economy is a giant fucking aircraft carrier, and those long-term effects will take a long time to happen. You can say, hey, the crash of 2008-2009 destroyed asset values so severely that the first $2 trillion or whatever of printing is only going to bring things up to where they were, and you don't have to worry about the hyperinflation until you get the $5 or $10 trillion after that. I mean, that's what you could say. That's probably what he was thinking, and he was right, you know? So, yeah. I mean, he wasn't making a call for the next 30 years. He was making a call probably for that year and, you know, maybe the year after. But I think he went back – a friend of mine, my friend told me today that he actually reiterated that he thought maybe in 2013, and he was right then also.
Mark,
so I – yeah.
Do you see something as a linchpin that if somebody just – pulled out from a joint in the economy, the whole thing could come down? Is there one thing or two, you know, one or two areas of the economy that you see, or one or two areas of the system where you really see risk that's concentrated to the point where if this part of the economy or this part of the system went up, the whole thing has a risk of coming down?
I don't know. People talk about corporations being over leveraged. So, you know, that happening, if we had like a shooting war, God forbid, with Asia, China, something, that would sure do it, look, I mean, and by the way, the other thing is stocks don't necessarily have to go up when the central bank prints money. I mean, look at Japan. Japan has been in essentially a ZERP environment for 30 years, and they've had some really severe bear markets in that time. So, I mean, I know my fund is positioned very heavily net short, you know, not just Tesla. And, you know, we didn't talk about other names, but I'm short now Square, Carvana, you know, Netflix, Tilray, and W, you know, the furniture.
That's a nice
Wayfair,
basket.
Wayfair. Yeah. I mean, it's a basket of bubble stocks, and most of them are garbage. Some of them, you know, I mean, even Netflix, which everybody loves. I mean, is that a business model? Spending $3-4 billion a year and burning it on content with all the, and with Disney coming and AT&T is now going to get serious and all these guys, right? It's not a business model. But look, Netflix is not a zero. I mean, at some point they'll have to consolidate everything, and you know, at some price, I don't know, 150, maybe somebody will buy them a share. I don't know. But anyway, so I don't, you know, I don't mean to. Netflix is probably the best of that bunch, you know. So anyway, so back to the point, which is this stuff can go on for a long time, and the Fed can print, and nothing may happen. So I'm very short now. I'm very short for a few reasons. One is there's still $50 billion a month of roll-off on the Fed balance sheet, much less printing. And Europe, of course, stopped printing as in January, but they do have negative rates there. The only printer is Japan, and Japan is now down to printing approximately 3% of the monetary base per year. They were at 30 or 40%. But they printed so much that the denominator got huge, and they're printing a lot less than they said they were going to print. They said they were going to print, you know, I think it was the equivalent of U.S. call it $800 billion a year, and they're printing like a third of that. So there isn't that much printing going on now. And you know, so, you know, money is tighter. I mean, we have real positive rates now for the first time in a long time. And I'm very comfortable being short. I mean, I think the markets essentially double topped a few weeks ago, and those are some ugly red candles today. I mean, I'm the index I'm short is the Russell 2000, the IWM ETF, because that's the most overpriced of all of them. It's got like a trailing gap PE of 39, I believe. You know, maybe it's a little better than that with today's downdraft. But, you know, people say, oh, well, that's because it's a lot of biotech. Healthcare is only – all of healthcare is only like 15% of the Russell 2000. So if you were going to say 10% of the Russell 2000 – that's the only money-losing biotech. Okay, so instead of 39, you know, the PE is 35. It's still ridiculous, right? On a GAAP basis, not an operating basis. So that's the index I'm short, and I'm very short that, because money is generally tightening here. Now, you know, if the roll-off stopped, I'd stay short. If the Fed decided it was going to start, you know, QE4, you know, then I'd probably be afraid, if nothing else, of the psychological aspect, and I'd get the hell out of it, you know. But you could have QE4 and stocks could still go down the same way the Japanese markets went down despite QE. So that's no guarantee of anything, you know.
You think if that happens, people start to lose confidence?
Well, look, yes. Yeah, people would lose confidence, but then they would print even more and even more. And eventually, if you shove enough, you know, printed money down somebody's throat, they puke it up, and there's your hyperinflation, right?
Yeah. So what's the line, right? How much?
What's the what?
How much?
Oh,
is
what's
too
the
much?
Line? No one knows what the line is, but we're probably nowhere near that line, just because.
But we don't know.
Well, you can't know, but
right.
You know, you're making a decision.
You know,
100%. But you're saying, I think we're pretty far from hyperinflation, and if they print again, you know, you could say this is what Tepper said. I'm going to get long because asset prices are going to go up for a while. And by the way, if we had hyperinflation, asset prices would really soar. You know, you don't want to be short a market in nominal terms,
right?
You're short unless there's some way to hedge it. You know, but you don't want to. I mean, you don't want to be short whatever the Venezuelan market priced in bolivars or whatever,
right?
You're going to get fucking killed, right? So yeah. Yeah, so, you know, so that's what's – I'm bearish. You know, we're very net short. And, you know, we've got – so, yeah, I mean, you know Wayfair, and, you know, it's a terrible business. So we're short that one. We're short Tilray. Tilray is, by the way, the only one that's expensive to borrow. It's – the borrow spiked up to the high 20-something percent range because it's a joke. It's selling at, like, you know –
150
it,
times sales.
Well, it's probably about – it's realistically, it's probably selling at about – roughly call it 40 times run rate revenue,
okay.
Right? And it's selling a commodity, so it's absurd. And you know, that's been, of course, the small float has kept that one going. And, you know, that fund Privateer, which is the big holder, they pledged they wouldn't sell any through the first half of this year. So the big question is, starting July 1, are they going to be starting to bleed out stock? Right. We don't know that they will, but if they do, you know, there goes the end of that one. You know, not only does the borrow get cheap, but you know, the float is out there and it goes down, right? All these other ones are paying me. Actually, they're actually positive carry trades, slightly. You know, like I'm getting more on my cash balance from Interactive Brokers than I'm paying to borrow these stocks. So they're all net like 1% to 2%. Yeah, look, 1% to 2% doesn't mean a lot if you have a stock that can move 5% in a day, right, or 1% to 2% a year. But yeah, so Netflix, cash burn, Tilray, you know, Wayfair, terrible business model. By the way, the Wayfair CEO, look at his Form 4s. He is just dumping stock.
Has been, too, for a while, right?
I think it's like every week on a 10b5. I mean, he's just dumping a lot of stock. I'm short Square. Square I'm short for two reasons. One is crazy valuation, like, I don't know, 100 times earnings. But the other reason is Square is run by, of course, Jack, who also started Twitter. And Jack has gone out of his way in interviews recently to talk about what a great guy Elon Musk is and how we'll do and how we'll do anything possible to support him, and Elon gets a bad rep and he's saving the world. And of course we all know that Elon is a total fucking securities fraudster. He can't deny that. And so in my book, Jack has got to be a very smart guy because he started these two companies, and therefore Jack knows exactly what the score is. And in my book, if someone like him is willing to say what a great guy an obvious securities fraudster is, I start asking enough questions that I want to be short that guy. And right. And when I mix that with the Square valuation and, you know, the fact that, you know, there's nothing particularly proprietary there. So that's why I'm short. That's why I'm short Square. I'm not short Twitter, by the way, because Twitter is an amazing platform and, you know, somebody would buy Twitter, but I don't know what's going on at Square. The financials are a little murky. I'm happy to be short it. And we're short Carvana, which is the used car vending machines, which is a joke. I mean, the guy who started it was like a convicted felon. And by the way, he's got the most amazing 10b5 I've ever seen. His 10b5 literally sells stock approximately every 2 days. You ever seen that before?
No, I've never seen that before.
Jack has one, or he had one. I haven't checked on it recently, but I think he still has it, where Jack was selling Square stock literally every week. I mean, 10b5 traditionally was every quarter the executive would sell some, right?
Right.
And then, like, the guy's like, oh, this guy's a little racy. You know, his 10b5 is once every month. That raises some eyebrows, right? Jack... What the fuck's his last name?
Jack Dorsey. Dorsey.
Yeah. Jack Deucebag. So Jack starving himself, pretends he doesn't eat anything, you know, douche. Anyway, his was like once a week, unless he suspended it recently. It was once a week as recently as like 2 weeks ago, which is like, that's really aggressive. And then I look at the – and by the way, I think the Waypoint guy is – or whatever his name is, Wayfair. I think that guy is like – weekly, if I'm not mistaken. But then I look at this Carvana, it's literally every 2 days. It's unbelievable, every two trading days. And Carvana just did an offering, a combination. I mean, they burn cash like crazy. You know, they're one of the few companies that manages to lose money selling used cars. I mean, that's like, who loses money? Who loses money ripping people off on used cars? It's like impossible. Anyway, so those guys just did an offering, common stock and converts. The stock offering was at 65, and it looks to me like the green shoe of the bankers that did the deal. It looks like it ran out. I mean, it traded a lot yesterday, and it traded more today, and the stock closed at six in the 63s, which would imply that they're out of money on that shoe, you know. So those are the I think that covers the other stuff I'm short. But, you know, just to be clear, each of those positions is, you know, like, call it 1/7 roughly, you know, the size of my Tesla short position. So so that's how we're positioned.
Tesla,
you know, we're long a couple of nano caps, but I've tweeted about them occasionally during my letter. But I don't really want to promote them. They're tiny little companies, and you know, you can find out what they are. You know.
All right, you got it. Well, listen, Mark, thank you so much for coming on, brother. Hopefully, we do it again relatively soon, man. Well, actually, the next time something happens. We'll
By the way, to come full circle, because maybe you're maybe you're too young.
Let's
but,
do that.
You know, no, but you know, Johnny Carson was the host of the Tonight Show for many, many years, maybe 30 years.
Okay.
You know, after Jack Parr, before Jay Leno, and like the greatest honor was to be on the Tonight Show and to be called back to Tonight Show. And if you were a comedian, which obviously I'm not, but the greatest honor there was you would do your stand-up set of 6-7 minutes, whatever. If Johnny then invited you to come sit next to him, you know, and to be interviewed,
that was
just
a big
deal.
Set, right.
That was the ultimate honor, right? Like that made your career. Like, oh, Johnny liked me. So you're like the Johnny of 4-letter word financial podcasts.
Oh, there you go. It's a small niche, but I had to just be spearheading ground somewhere, man.
All right, man. Thank you.
Mark Spiegel, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only Mark Spiegel from Stanfield Capital. Always a pleasure to have on the podcast. Want to thank him again so much for coming on. I will be back relatively soon. Got a couple of nice things lined up for this weekend. Just one more time, want to thank my patrons, especially with Seeking Alpha now dropping me. I do lose a tiny bit of revenue from that, so some people have stepped up on Patreon, and for that, very much, I appreciate you guys. I will be back relatively soon, but for right now, motherfuckers, it's 6 o'clock, and I am out of here. Peace!